Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Pentagon didn't get everything it wanted for 2017, but it got a lot, $524 billion in the base, plus another $59 billion for overseas contingency operations. It's a mix of cost-cutting reforms and investments in what the brass see as five strategic challenges. Joining me with analysis, Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Brian, good to have you back.
Great to be here. Thank you, Tom.
So in looking at this big budget, and there's hundreds and thousands of pages of documentation behind it, what is the clear picture, if any, that you see as what the administration is trying to do with military forces in 2017?
Right. So I'd say what's interesting is that here in the last year of the administration, they've finally started to reflect a strategy in their budget. So in previous years, so in the first years that the Obama administration came in, they wanted to get out of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They wanted to make some reductions in military spending, but there was not a dramatic change that had been identified by the Obama administration when they came in. And then the Budget Control Act in 2011 came along and really forced a reevaluation of the strategy. So they said that they were going to start, you know, looking away from large stability operations like we had done in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're going to be focusing on kind of the smaller, higher-end wars that they anticipated in the future. But not a lot of changes in the budget to reflect that other than the cuts that the Budget Control Act prescribed. Now, in this budget, the Budget Control Act caps are still in place, amended by the budget deal that was done last year. But now they're kind of doubling down on the idea that they're focused on high-end warfare against great power competitors, as the Secretary of Defense calls them, so Russia and China.
That was an interesting phrase, great power, because, right, you know, since Gorbachev fell, we've been calling ourselves the only superpower. But right, now it seems to be conceding or admitting, or I don't know what the right verb is, that there are other, I guess, nearly equal powers.
Right. Most of the people in the national security establishment would say that those other powers are not as capable militarily as the United States, but they are powers in their own right that have to be reckoned with and that they have their own distinct advantages. So China, for example, has the advantage that anything we would want to do with them militarily or against them militarily is going to happen in their backyard. So the countries that we would try to protect, so Korea, Japan, Taiwan, et cetera, they're all right next to China, whereas we're going to have to come a long ways from the United States. Russia, similarly, is right next to the countries that it would hope to coerce. And those are all allies of ours that we're going to have to now travel thousands of miles to protect.
They've been talking about the pivot to Asia for a long time.
Right.
Does this budget reflect a pivot to Asia?
So there are some dollars there towards what's called the Asia Maritime Security Initiative, which is a greater military cooperation between ourselves and some of our Asian partners, but not a significant change. So if you look in here, you're not going to find
three new carriers.
Right, right. There's not a lot of investment that's geared towards Asia specifically. But there is going to be some investment geared towards the higher end kind of conflict that people anticipate we might have with China. So things like electronic warfare and new missile systems and new space and surveillance systems, those kinds of higher end capabilities are what they would argue are parts of that pivot to Asia.
And what about the strategic offset? Is that expressed budgetarily, did you see?
Yeah, so there is a significant increase in some of the capabilities that the SecDef and the Deputy Secretary have identified as being part of this third offset strategy. So electronic warfare gets a significant boost. You know, so if you look at just the Air Force, which has not been a big player in that mission area, their budget for electronic warfare went from being less than $1 billion to being more than $10 billion, almost $12 billion worth of investment.
And that means retrofitting existing planes?
It means buying new systems mostly. So it's mostly electronic warfare systems in this case that would go onto an existing airplane or that might go on an unmanned vehicle or that might go on a ground vehicle or a ground system. And the Navy's got a similar increase in investment in those kind of capabilities. Lots of new weapons investments that are part of this third offset. So new missile systems for airplanes and for ships and also for ground-based systems, and then also a greater investment in the kind of surveillance capabilities that you would need to target those precision weapons. So a lot of move in that direction. Space capabilities, undersea capabilities get a significant increase here with increases to the amount of Virginia payload modules that the Navy is going to install on their new attack submarines, which carry missiles, and then also in some other undersea systems that the Navy is developing. So there's investment in those high-end areas that were part of the third offset. They pay for those in part with some reductions in the capacity of the force. So they're making a little bit of a choice there with regard to how big the force is and then how capable it is.
I want to get back to that force point, but I wanted to also ask you about one budget item I noticed, and that was, I think, $6.7 billion for what they call cyber offensive operations.
Right.
And that's a word they kind of slipped in their summary on page four.
Right.
but that sounds like a big deal.
Yeah, and that is part of this third offset strategy, is to invest in cyber capabilities. And traditionally, cyber has been something we talk about in terms of defense. We're always worried about what do people do if they attack our electrical grid or if they attack our financial networks. But there's also a large offensive dimension of it, too, that in the past we focused at mostly on the counterterrorism fight. So you use it to go find bad guys and hunt them down. Now we're looking at, you know, ways to develop tools that you would actually use in kind of higher end warfare, similar to what like Russia has done against Georgia and then against Ukraine. They attacked the computer networks of those countries' militaries before they went in and attacked them physically. So those are the kind of capabilities that DoD would develop. Now most of that money is going to go to people, because the humans have to do it. If you think about just like coders out in Silicon Valley, you just buy a lot of coders and they spend a lot of time writing programs. So a lot of that money is going to go toward that.
We're speaking with Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And let's get back to that issue of people. There's a slight reduction from 15 to 16 to 17, but it doesn't look like wholesale troop reductions on the troop level.
Right. So the Army is continuing on its glide slope to get to 450,000 troops by 2018. And so that's going to be continuing, while the Navy is shrinking a surprising number of people. Actually, about 6,000 to 7,000 people are coming out of the Navy, which you wouldn't ordinarily think as being something that would need to shrink.
But that's like a group worth of people.
Right. So they're getting rid of, the Navy's getting rid of a carrier air wing and four aircraft squadrons. You know, so right there, that's, you know, almost 1,000 people of that reduction comes out of there. It's not necessarily, you know, it's not apples to apples, but that's about the number of people they're going to be getting rid of there. But so the Navy's losing a lot of people. Army's continuing its glide slope down. The Marine Corps is kind of stabilizing at 182,000 where it was before. And the Air Force is, I think, growing slightly to address shortfalls they've had on the maintenance side. They need more maintainers.
And what about the special forces upon which there has been so much reliance in recent years?
Right. So Special Forces is going to continue to grow a little bit, but not very much. And so the Special Forces are going to be continue to be stressed, because they're going to be demanded in excess of the capacity that they can generate reliably and continuously.
So basically, the philosophy behind this seems to be that we want to zap them electronically rather than shoot them in person.
Exactly. Yeah, there's going to be a greater reliance on the kinds of things we would use to attack an enemy from farther away, or to attack him with electrons, either through a wire or through the air, and maybe using special operators or drones. So those kinds of capabilities that would do it from a little bit removed, rather than doing it up close and personal like we might have done in the past.
So given your experience in special forces and looking at these budgets for so many years, is this a budget of strength?
I would argue that it's a budget that has a clear strategic direction within the fiscal constraints that they have. So I don't know that it's necessarily a budget of strength, because it's a significant reduction from what they had anticipated having in last year's budget. So it's a $17 billion reduction in this budget relative to what they thought they were going to have last year. So it's a big cut, and so that cut had to be taken somewhere, and so they've made this choice to favor capability investments for the strategy over the capacity they might need to deliver that capability. So I think if I was looking at it from a China or a Russia perspective, I'd be saying, okay, well, in the long term, they're going to invest in the capabilities they need to defeat me, but in the near term, they may not have the capacity to keep forces present out here, and I can maybe bully my neighbors in the meantime.
So old Vladimir is probably poring over this one.
Right, to see where he might be able to identify some vulnerabilities in the force structure.
All right, Brian Clark is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The National Security Cutter is at the heart of a long-running effort to modernize the Coast Guard. Three of the ships have already been built and deployed. The Coast Guard, with test and evaluation help from the Navy, says the ships are effective and suitable for their mission. The Government Accountability Office is saying, not so fast. Joining me with more, Michelle Mackin, Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management Issues at the GAO. Ms. Mackin, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, give us the overview of this program. This is not just a small program. It's a big, long-running, long-term situation, correct?
This is a long-running program, and the flagship, frankly, of the Coast Guard's cutter fleet, the National Security Cutter. It's about a $6 billion program. And as you mentioned, three of the ships are operational, seven of eight are either delivered or under contract at this point.
And looking at the diagram that the GAO put in the most recent report that you oversaw, it looks like this ship has problems literally stem to stern.
There have been some issues. The key event was the operational test event that happened in the spring of 2014. There were 10 major deficiencies that the Navy test agent identified there. Also, some key performance requirements that weren't met. In addition to that, there have been known for many years, several years, that retrofits are going to be needed on the ship to replace certain pieces of equipment. And with the operational fleet, there have been some issues identified, for example, engine failures in warm water, which is limiting the speed of the ship, and cracked cylinder heads that are occurring at a higher rate than expected.
Well, I guess if the engine quits, then pretty much you don't have much to go on at that point.
It's a problem. As I mentioned, the key impact right now is that they can't achieve their planned transit speed in warm water conditions. But the key there is they don't really know why these failures are occurring. So there's some studies underway, but those issues are certainly impacting the operations of the ship.
And who is the prime contractor for the ships that have been built so far?
It's Huntington Ingalls down in Mississippi, and this particular program was part of the Deepwater program, which began in the early 2000s, and so it has been long-running, as you mentioned.
And is the shipbuilder and also the engine company, which I guess is probably a separate contractor, are they involved in looking at the problems as to why these engines are blowing up in warm water?
Absolutely. The engine is a separate contract for that, and the engine manufacturer is very involved in determining why this is happening, and then, of course, how to fix it.
And so at this point, nobody knows really what to do.
That's right. These propulsion problems, in addition to the ones I mentioned, the generators are overheating. You know, there have been patrols that were cut short because they didn't have the backup generators working. So I think of all the issues we've identified, these failures in the propulsion system are probably the most troubling.
If the propulsion system quits, and suppose that Coast Guard ship maybe is under attack by small boats, you know, from terrorists or this kind of thing, could that be a problem? Could it endanger the ship?
It could. And in addition to the engine issues, some of the items that were identified in the operational test were the ability to deter or destroy an anti-ship cruise missile. That couldn't be tested because the testing drone wasn't available to use. So there are other impacts in addition to the engine that could be safety issues, yes.
And it looks like some of the weapon systems and the radars are not all that up to snuff either.
The combat systems did have failures in the operational testing. The close-in weapon system, the air search radar, the 57-millimeter gun all had failures, and those will be tested again in the follow-on testing, which is important to mention. That will start this fall and continue at least through 2017. So again, that'll be another very rigorous test event that hopefully the Coast Guard will be able to do better with some of these systems.
Now, your latest report then is really not about the deficiencies themselves, which were already identified, but in the way that the test program is conducted?
That was part of it, and this operational testing is really important. The key there is that it happened pretty late for the National Security Cutter, after three ships were already in operations. Ideally, you'd want to do this operational testing earlier because obviously you discover things in testing. That's the point of the testing. That would give you an opportunity to make some fixes before additional ships are delivered to the fleet.
Otherwise, they were ready to go ahead and start building however many they're supposed to get.
Yes. Seven of the eight planned ships were already in construction or delivered at the time of the operational testing. And that is something that the Offshore Patrol Cutter, which is a $12 billion program, much larger than the National Security Cutter, is going to be starting very soon, and the Coast Guard plans to do the operational testing after only one of those 25 planned ships is operational. So that should be an improvement.
Same general contractor for those ships also?
Unknown at this point. The Coast Guard plans to award a construction contract later this year.
Okay. We're speaking with Michelle Mackin, Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Issues at the GAO. And I was interested to find that the Navy has a large part of the testing role for the Coast Guard. Is that something new, or is that pretty common, and why do they need the Navy?
It's common. The Navy's done operational testing on many, if not all, of the Coast Guard assets. They have the expertise to do it, and the Coast Guard has partnership with them, and it's good to have that independent look, especially for these critical operational test events.
Has there ever been a study done of whether the Coast Guard could use a Navy design and just adapt it for their own use? I mean, is there a destroyer that could do the trick or something like that, that where the bugs have been worked out over a number of years?
You would think so. The National Security Cutter has many commonalities with the Navy's littoral combat ship, which has had problems of its own. The Coast Guard and Navy have never opted to go that route, however.
So this new National Security Cutter, is it on hold while they fix these issues, or are they still rolling forward with the acquisition of the follow-on ships?
They're rolling forward. Seven of eight are already under contract or have been built or delivered. The eighth will be coming up very soon, and Congress recently appropriated money for a ninth National Security Cutter. So nothing has slowed down in terms of the acquisition approach.
And still having the same 57-millimeter gun that has had problems and the same engines and generators that have had problems?
Yes. So hopefully that the propulsion studies that are underway with the engine manufacturer will be able to figure out why these problems are happening and maybe get some fixes underway for the ships that are still at the shipyard.
And just a detail question. I see one of the problem areas is something called a single-point davit. I don't even hang my canoe from a single point. What is the issue with that one?
The issue is in higher sea states, it's dangerous to launch the small boats that launch from the National Security Cutter off of that single-point davit. They're prototyping a dual-point davit and testing that. So the plan, would be to retrofit all of the NSCs with the dual-point davit after it's been properly tested, and it should be safer to use.
In other words, it wouldn't swing around so much, the small boat, while it's trying to be lowered.
Absolutely correct.
And by the same token, there's a crane at the rear of the ship which launches something larger, a cutter boat, and that's been a problem also?
That's the gantry crane. Again, it's launching these smaller boats off the stern of the ship. And the issue there is that the gantry crane was never intended for a maritime environment. It's experiencing a lot of corrosion and obviously taking many, many maintenance hours to fix, and you do have to ask yourself why that particular crane was installed on a ship when it wasn't intended for maritime operations.
And so what is the Coast Guard's general response so far to your report?
The Coast Guard has always been very amenable to our recommendations. You know, they understand that they have to do some follow-on testing and retrofits of the gantry crane and the davit launch system. So they've always agreed with our recommendations and have made some improvements to their acquisition strategy for the Offshore Patrol Cutter, for example.
So in the meantime, if you're on a National Security Cutter, you should probably have a few spare paddles aboard.
Spare parts actually have been an issue with all of these cracked cylinder heads, the generators, the engine failures. The ships in operation have had some trouble getting an adequate pipeline of spare parts because they're failing at a rate greater than they had expected.
Well, Michelle Mackin is Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Issues at the GAO. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Find a link to her report and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.